Tales through time.
Welcome back to Tales Through Time. I'm Troy Newman.
And I'm Keegan Rudwick.
Keegan, we're going to immediately start this episode getting into a bit of a heavier topic. Have you ever been in a relationship that you knew was not healthy?
Yes. And I think we've all been there where we have been in love with that person and kind of seen the flags and have chose to ignore them. For one of my relationships, it was a lot of boundary setting that was being crossed, a lot of boundaries being crossed. And that eventually led to a relationship breakup.
It just wasn't healthy at the time.
Exactly.
I had something similar back when I was in college. It wasn't just her, though. It was also me. I am very different nowadays than what I was back then, but it clearly was not working. So we decided to go our own ways. I believe towards the end, we tried making some kind of amends, realizing that we were just in different places in our life. So we decided to move on.
And that happens where you kind of are potentially, I know some people will say, oh, you know, we're the right people, but, you know, not at the right time. Maybe they reconnect years later. For that relationship, I do think it was wrong person, wrong time. I tried setting boundaries. You know, I need to have a good night's sleep because I have to be up a lot earlier. I pick up around the house, essentially, you know, kind of be essentially turned into a caretaker role, which in turns, you know, left me frustrated, which then left them frustrated. And so it was just at that time, it was like just best to move apart.
I feel like those situations are often difficult to get ourselves out of, not just because the other person might want to continue trying, but also because the person that you develop feelings for, they are still there in a way. You might not see it as frequently, but you can still see it often enough that you want to stick around for that person who they were when you first met.
It's left a frustration on both people's part because who's ever changed, they're going to be held to that standard of like, well, this is how you who you used to be, and this is who I cared about, but you're different from that person. And so I think that's just the part of growing up and maturing.
That leads us to today's interview, Kathy Enos. However, we're not going to be starting with a relationship that defined so much of her life. Instead, we're going to be starting off where everything starts off, at the beginning.
My dad was an alcoholic. And actually, one of my first memories is him coming home drunk and dragging everybody out of bed. And the fighting. I, of course, wasn't involved in it because I was too little to fight back. To say I grew up in a chaotic household would be an understatement. And I was the youngest, so I probably didn't. Well, no, I think sometimes when you're the youngest, you're actually more affected by it. I remember that I had a little old lady who lived next door to me who was, I called her Schwartzy. Schwartzy saved my life. And Schwartzy taught me about God. Because we just lived right next door that close. And so she had to hear what was going on. And she just kind of took me under her wing, and she was my safe place to fall.
Is that how she saved your life, just by being there for you?
By being there for me. And teaching me about love and kindness and God. Her husband had been a Methodist minister. And so she was very spiritual. So she truly, truly is who taught me about God and about having faith. And so I just thought Schwartzy belonged to me. I didn't know that she had other family. I wish that I could have told her how much she meant to me and how she actually shaped so much of who I am. She taught me about honesty. She taught me about she taught me so many things that and I don't think my kids really don't know just how vital Schwartzy was to my survival.
When you think about her, is there a specific memory that comes to mind?
Every Sunday she wouldn't turn on her electricity, so she used kerosene lamps. And I would sit on her lap and we would read the Bible and we would sing hymns out of the Methodist hymnal.
Like many of those that we've heard from already, Kathy's life started off in a difficult place. For obvious reasons, parents define what our childhoods were like. It's unfortunate when those major players have such a negative impact.
Especially because your parents and your family members are supposed to be the ones that kind of give you that foundation, that stability for that sound emotional upbringing, and Kathy's had a, not had, but she found that in a neighbor.
This is the very start of the interview. So it started off in a very difficult place for Kathy, but I was glad to hear that, like you said, she was able to find that foundation in a neighbor, Schwartzy. And that neighbor, as Kathy mentioned, helped shape the rest of her life. We haven't heard it yet, but Schwartzy also gave Kathy a bit of a softer edge compared to her siblings. Some of the examples she would give later in the interview, her sister would be willing to fight back, would be willing to defend herself, but Kathy in particular tried being more of a jokester, and she credits that softer edge to this neighbor, Schwartzy.
And there was one instance, and I was somewhere in that age, again, 3 or 4, and I've gone through counseling and I've tried to remember what the memory was. My folks were gone, and my brother was supposed to be watching me, and something happened to this little girl, and I ran to Schwartzy, and whatever it was, I must have told her, because she put me in bed with her, and when my brother came knocking on the door, she wouldn't let me go. She wouldn't let me go home with him. She said she's safe. She's in bed now. So I remember I snuggled in with Schwartzy. And then of course the next morning, early, my mother came knocking on the door, because she apparently came home, probably didn't even know I wasn't home, but woke up in the morning and I wasn't there. And so she came knocking on Schwartzy's. But, you know, it's interesting. It's one of those things where I've gone through counseling. I've really worked to try to remember what happened to me that time. But it's the way the counselor explained it is that you if something traumatic happens and it never gets talked about again, you don't store it in your long-term memory. So apparently whatever it was very traumatic, and I blocked it out.
You said something happened to a little girl.
I was that little girl. That was that little girl. I was, and I was that little girl that didn't deserve whatever it was. And somebody I was supposed to be able to trust. And I don't know that it was even my brother, because there was a neighbor involved too. I don't know that it was even him. But it's interesting that, I mean, yeah.
How old were you at that time?
I was 3 or 4. I wasn't very old.
Based on what she described, as essentially she disassociated from that situation. Mm-hmm. It didn't happen to her. In her own words, it happened to that little girl.
Like she mentioned, she looks back, she sees that curly blonde-haired girl and almost doesn't recognize her, recognizes that it should be her, but in a way it's not. And that might be because who she was before this one incident and who she is after simply are not the same. Much of Kathy's childhood was difficult because of her family. However, there would come a point where, like we had mentioned earlier, Kathy and her sister would start taking on roles within the family.
I was more passive. You know, my job in the family was to make people laugh. That was when I got old enough to do that. That was what I used, was my dry, sarcastic wit. And that part of me my kids do know. And Linda fought. She fought my mother, she fought my dad, she fought everybody, and I didn't do that. I didn't really fight back. I just kind of shrunk into the corner, except that years later, 50 years later, I ran into somebody that I knew in school, and he said, "What I remember about you is your sense of humor." And I said, I didn't know I had a sense of humor. But I did. And so it's interesting. Now, Linda was very hard around the edges and always told me that she was born street smart and I wasn't. Because then I think I can thank Schwartzy for that, that I had that softer, nature where I didn't fight everybody. I didn't, there was a reason, some reason. He never beat me, but he was so mean to my mom. And I sometimes think that as a child, when you see that, it would almost be easier if you were the one getting beat on than to see. My mother was she had to be tough and strong. And she, I remember when I was about 11 or 12, I said, "Why don't you leave him?" And she cried and said, "What am I going to do? I don't have an education. I don't have a job."
Hearing her retell her story is very challenging to listen to because it just, some of it reflects on my own. And so like hearing her account, you can definitely hear like it's still affecting her to this day. And it's like that trauma, that disassociation. It's like you're there, you're hearing it. It's like almost like it's bringing her back to that moment. And when she mentioned, you know, asking her mother, why can't she leave? You hear that a lot when partners are talking about why they were in an abusive relationship or in a challenging relationship for so long is because they didn't have the means to leave. Maybe they've become financially dependent upon their partner. Maybe they're alienated from friends and family.
It's a story that we hear too often.
Exactly.
Where someone feels like they can't leave because they feel like they don't have the means to leave, the means to support themselves.
And thankfully, there are more ways to contact and reach out to get those means to leave, mm-hmm. get that support nowadays.
Kathy was able to leave this difficult situation with her father once she started getting her own family, when she married her first husband. However, even then, it still wasn't easy for her.
Art was a real ass. He was not a good husband. The kids have chosen to remember everything good about Art. You know, Andy will tell you that his dad was there for him. His dad wasn't there for him. His dad, he irreparably, and I played a role in it. Don't get me wrong. I played a role in it because I allowed it to happen. He gambled and he drank and he ran around with other women and did some dishonest things. And I stayed, and I should not have stayed. At one point, I woke up in the middle of the night and thought, oh my God, I married my dad. But I didn't fight back with Art. Whereas with my second husband, I learned that I do too have a mouth, and I didn't. So it's interesting. It's interesting. And it's kind of like I repeated history.
What drew you to Art?
I don't know. 3 weeks before I married him, my mother begged me not to marry him.
Do you think she kind of...
She saw it. She saw what I refused to see. And I, of course, I cried and said, no, I have to. The invitations are out. And she said, you don't have to, Kathy. You don't have to marry him. You don't have to do it. But I did anyway. I don't know. I don't know. I loved him. There's no question about it. I loved him, and I loved him enough to stay with him and have four kids with him. And unfortunately, by the time I left him, though, I hated him.
When people grow up in sort of a chaotic and traumatic household, they may find themselves back in the same environment when they're older because it's an environment that they're used to, despite it being chaotic. It's that your brain eventually adapts to that difficulty and it finds comfort, and anything outside that actually makes a person feel uncomfortable. And it's unfortunate that she kind of found herself in there. Her mother tried stopping the wedding, helping her kind of see what was happening. And it just comes back to kind of what I mentioned at the start, is that you enter a relationship, you love the person, you enjoy who they are, you know and you see the red flags, but you either acknowledge them consciously or subconsciously, and you still kind of push through and overlook them because there are just a few good parts that really shine through. She did get four children, so obviously not all bad.
She doesn't explicitly say it in the interview, but kind of like we were talking at the beginning of the episode, when we were talking about our own relationships, we can often find ourselves in situations where we are sticking with someone simply because of who they used to be, or who we thought they were when we first met them. Kathy doesn't explicitly say that's why she ended up staying with Art for so long, but it could very well be one of the reasons. Because towards the end of that answer that we just heard, she said that she loved Art at the beginning, which I would hope you love who you're marrying.
Hopefully.
But towards the end of their marriage, she said she hated him. It's just unfortunate that it took her so long to realize and actually comprehend the red flags that those around her were seeing. In Kathy's and Art's marriage, it wasn't just the confrontations or the fighting that made it difficult, though.
And it's sad because, you know, nobody is born broken. But somewhere along the line, Art got broken. Because he didn't have a clue. He didn't have a clue. So it was easier to stay stuck in what he was doing and how he was doing it. Whether it was destroying everything around him or not, that was familiar and that was easy for him to do. That was the easy way out. You know, Art had a few things. For one thing, Art was the youngest of, can you imagine trying to live up to Tommy Thompson's image? And Ed was the consummate bad boy. And so he was always in trouble. And Julianne was this high achiever. She became a college professor, and Tommy became governor of the state of Wisconsin and the head of the Department of Health and Human Services. And Ed was always larger than life, and then there was Art. And Art was, when he was eight years old, his grandpa George died, and his grandma did not want to be alone. And so they wanted one of the kids to come and stay with her. Well, of course, Tommy wasn't going to do that. Ed sure as hell wasn't going to do it. So at 8 years old, Art was forced to, every night until he was 14, he was forced to go stay with, they called her Dada. Art was forced to do that. And he said he cried. He cried and said, I don't want to go. But they made him go. And to start out with, when he was eight, he had to sleep with Dada. Not that there was anything, I'm not saying there was anything that went on that way, but so that little boy got pulled out of his own house and every night had to go stay with Dada. Until finally when he was 14, he got so he refused to go, he wouldn't do it anymore. And then they put Dada in a home. But can you imagine what that did to that little boy? Well, you've got to go stay with your grandma now. We love you, but you got to stay with grandma. That, you can't do that to a child. He couldn't go out and play kick the can at night with his friends or hide and seek or whatever games kids played. He couldn't do that. So think how soul destroying that was to that little boy, that he had to do that. And so that explains some of his damage. Plus, he had a very controlling, not that he was mean. I don't think his dad was mean to him, but he was very controlling, and you ruled with an iron fist.
I think Kathy said to herself, the kind of potential issues that could be inflicted upon you, the sort of behaviors and thought patterns that you would grow into, because essentially from what, 8 to 14, 6 years, he was being taken from his home to spend somewhere he didn't want to. You know, eventually you would just grow obstinate and kind of have, once you gain that freedom, would kind of go maybe a little bit, I don't want to say crazy, but you would find a newfound appreciation and live that freedom, which...
Go overboard.
Yeah, exactly. Go overboard, in which he ended up doing.
There's no excuse in my mind for the kinds of things Kathy says Art has done during their relationship. That being said, being Art could not have been easy either. And kind of like you mentioned, this gives us a little bit of an insight into some of the things that Art himself had to struggle with as well.
And it's potential that maybe if this didn't happen, would he have gone to lead on a different life?
How would he have been different later in life? How would he have been as a father, as a husband, had he not gone through these kinds of things when he was a child?
In a way, it's a burden a child shouldn't have to carry. That should be the responsibility of the parents. Like, that's... Given we don't know the state of her health at that time, but if he was having to take on a more of a caretaker role, like an 8-year-old should not be doing that, a 10-year-old, a 14-year-old, not in that sort of capacity. And she mentioned that after he left, she had to go to a home.
because he was Tommy's brother, everything was always newsworthy. So Art made the news quite often. He made the paper, and that was embarrassing for me. But I worried more about how damaging it was to my kids, that their dad was constantly screwing up and doing things. And it affected the kids. And the two that were affected the most were Andy and John. Matt and Mark had him when they were younger, and he hadn't gone off the rails quite as much. And Andy and John, that was probably, if you have one regret, is that I didn't get out of there sooner. And I do regret that.
So now that you're thinking back on it, why do you think you stuck around?
Because I didn't know I had options. I didn't know I had a choice. I didn't know. I thought you got married, you stayed. And even when it was blatant, everybody in town knew that he was having an affair with this woman. And I still stayed. If I had it to do over again. But I don't, so I can't change it.
As Kathy mentioned, just being a part of that Thompson family made Art newsworthy. It wasn't just the fighting or even the cheating that Kathy just alluded to. It was that everything Art was doing, and by proxy, everything that her family was doing, was in a way newsworthy.
I couldn't imagine having to live life with everything of your, you know, the skeletons in your closet being sprawled across the front page of the news story for everyone to read. That's a whole nother level of invasion of privacy, a difficulty of handling any sort of situation that you're in, because every move you make is being scrutinized by everyone.
Speaking of our skeletons being spread across the front page of the newspaper, that's actually how Kathy found out what Art was doing.
And he said, oh, I'm on administrative leave because I made a racial slur. And stupidly, I believed him. And I even defended him. And anyway, so this went on for probably 6 months. And that was what he told everyone. And he would have to go to Oshkosh for meetings. Turns out what he was going to Oshkosh for was court. But one Saturday morning, I went to work. I worked at Land's End, so I went to work. And I always bought a newspaper, and I opened up the newspaper, and it says, Governor's brother charged with sexual assault. And it was Art. That was the final straw. That was it. I knew I was done. And I can't even blame the woman involved, because if it hadn't been her, it would have been somebody else. I mean, I could blame her, and I don't like her, and I did blame her, but it really, truly, if it hadn't been her, it would have been somebody else. And if I'd had the backbone back in, say, 1990, to put my foot down and say, you know, this is no way, this is it. But instead, I chose to be crushed and I guess be a victim. I played the victim role very well.
So basically exactly what I mentioned earlier, she now found out something that he was doing literally on the front page, and he hid it from her the entire time.
Not only her either. As she mentioned, he was telling everyone a different story than what had actually happened. Art was trying to tell everyone that he was on paid administrative leave because of a racial slur, when in reality, it was sexual assault allegations.
What baffles me is that he was the governor's brother. The fact that he tried to hide it at all, instead of maybe potentially getting in front of it as he would in a political realm. Obviously, I'm not condoning any of that. What I'm saying is that instead he lied and hid it from everyone, and then for it to come out to news, it's just your brother's in a public-facing position, like it's going to come across. Like there's nothing that you could potentially do to hide that.
There's never an excuse for doing this kind of thing. It makes even less sense when your family is so noteworthy, because you should almost realize that everything you do is going to be scrutinized in one way or another. Despite this massive case being made against the brother of the governor of Wisconsin, he still tried to hide it. As Kathy said, her learning of the allegations made against her husband was the final straw, and it's something that, along with the relationship she had with Art, she would have to one day come to terms with.
I remember when I told him I was going to counseling, and of course, our life was beginning to unravel, and he said, oh great, you'll find out your dad was an alcoholic, and that's why you have all these problems. And yes, indeed, that was a source of, but what it did, what it was really, was that growing up like I did and having a mother who stayed set me up to think that was what you did and not have a backbone. And being this passive child that I was, I didn't fight back with anybody. I didn't fight back. And Art would do things like put holes in the walls. And I think what my mother was referring to was one time before we got married, we got into an argument or a fight about something, and he dented the side of the car. He hit the side of the car so hard he dented it. And that may have been why I was home crying. And my mother said, you don't have to go through with this. And I remember her saying, they don't get better, they only get worse. And so she did see that. She did see, and he would put holes in walls. He never hit me, but he would put holes in walls. And one time after my mother had passed away, he got mad at me. And again, it was mainly about this lady friend. That was what we fought the most about. But I remember him, I had a shelf with my mother's little knickknacks on it, and he took and threw every one of the pieces off the shelf at me. So John was only little then. He was 9 or 10. And that, I left the house that night. I left the house that night and slept down at his office downtown. And it was like deja vu. John said, why don't you leave him, Mom? Why don't you leave him? And I didn't have an answer, but it was like I went back all those years to hear my mother saying, or to hear me saying to my mother, why don't you leave? And that the message I got from that was that she couldn't. And I can't blame my mother, because she was a cool person. But she wasn't perfect, but she was a cool person. And Art came down to the office the next day. I don't know how he figured out where we were, but he, and of course he promised that he would never ever, that things would change, that it was never gonna be like that again, and blah, blah, blah. So I stayed. It was interesting because he never would have left me. He'd have just strung along and been, things would have just been status quo the way they were. But I knew that he was very selfish and self-centered.
So essentially she found herself in the same position that her mother was in, and her son was asking her, you know, why don't you leave? Why don't you go? It's unfortunate that she found herself in that situation and that she stayed after her mom told her what was happening. And again, like we've mentioned multiple times, you overlook these flags when you love someone. She ended up finding that strength to leave. They got that divorce in 2004. But she made that comment of, oh, but he didn't hit me. It's a phrase that is said when people are kind of recounting, you know, the relationship, you know, when they are talking about after leaving an abusive situation, because again, it's not happening to them, it's not inflicting pain, and so they can stay. But of course, she mentioned that she fled the home when he started throwing things at her. I think it's kind of the key takeaway is that if you find yourself saying that phrase, you should probably be reaching out to a support system at that point.
It's almost a way of normalizing the behavior, because like you mentioned, that person isn't hurting me. It's a way of almost distancing yourself from the situation, because if they're not physically hurting you, then are they actually abusing you?
Exactly. It's essentially you're dissociating and you're coping.
So up until this point, Kathy had been talking a lot about the negative aspects of her life, the relationship that she had with her father, and the unfortunate relationship that she had with Art. But among all this, there were still some happy times. There were still some things that she wouldn't change. For instance, her kids.
Matt and Mark were older and a little more able to handle it. But Andy and John, that was kind of soul-crushing to them. And Andy definitely suffers from middle child syndrome, even though he was the third one. He was the one, he was kind of the lost child in the family. He was, just like when I was telling you about the story about when I said, you're both assholes. And then the teacher said, so how are you, Kathy? And I said, I just called my two oldest boys assholes. How do you think I am? And by that time, I was as little concerned about how Andy was doing at that moment. And that was kind of been the story of his life. I can't go back. I can't change it. But Andy was the lost child. He was the lost one. He was the one that Mark brutalized him. Not so much physically, but he bullied him and put him in closets and kept him there. I didn't know that, but he kept him in a closet all day long and told him he was the supreme being. And of course, Andy was threatened within an inch of his life if he ever told. So he never told. I didn't know this till these kids were adults. And so I think Andy still feels that way. Of all the kids that I've worried the most about, he's been the one I've worried the most about because he was definitely the lost child. Not that I meant for him to be the lost child, but he was. And I worried about John, but I worried about John for different reasons because John acted out by getting into trouble and doing drugs and drinking and making poor decisions, where Andy didn't really act out till after he got divorced. And that's when his world fell apart. It was interesting growing up with, or having four boys. It was funny and it was frustrating and they were wild and it was wonderful. I mean, it was. And I can look back on each one of them and I can just tell you funny things that they said and did. And Andy probably said the most funny things. One time, he'd been up at my mother's for a week, and he was real close with our neighbors, Marge and Doug Johnson. And Doug was, when he got back home, he was down at Doug's, and Doug was doing something under the kitchen sink. And whatever happened, he cussed and swore, and Andy backed up and said, "Whoa, I didn't do it. I was in Wonewalk all week." And so, I mean, it was just things like that that Drew said that were funny. One time he was walking across the pavement, and back then I really didn't swear in front of the kids. But he was walking, and he said, "Jesus, this is hot. Jesus Christ, this is hot." So he was funny. One day he said to me, "It was cold out there, Mom. It was cold. It was so cold I might have froze my little wiener white off."
I like these two clips from her interview because she mentioned when she was younger that she found Schwartzy to cope during the rough times. And she used humor, again, to cope with the difficulties, which a lot of people do. And her son, Andy, is also mimicking the exact same things that she was doing. So he's close with the neighbors. He's using humor to cope. You know, siblings can fight and argue, but maybe it was a little bit too far at times. And again, whatever Andy's experience, or, you know, that maybe was traumatic for him and on some level, or, you know, a little bit difficult. And again, he's mirroring everything that his mom did.
We already talked about once earlier how history kind of repeated itself when Kathy's son asked her why she didn't just leave art, kind of like how Kathy asked her mother why her mother didn't just leave her father. And here we have another instance of her sons kind of bringing up a piece of her own history and making it part of their lives in a way, whether knowingly or not, where she was the family jokester when she was a child. Andy is doing the same here. Her kids weren't the only bright spot in her life, though. After she left art, Kathy was also able to find a much healthier relationship with her second husband.
We're at a bar in Union Center, and Ronnie was there, and he was sober. He was in a sober phase. And so we'd known each other all our lives. And I said, in conversation with him, we talked for a while, and I, out of kind of out of the clear blue, I said to him, it hasn't been easy being married to Art Thompson. And he said, really, I didn't know that. And I found myself spilling my guts to him, just like I've kind of spilled my guts to you here today, but probably even a little more in depth. And he was so kind to me and got it. He didn't use it as a tool. He just, when he left, then he said, I gotta go. And he kissed me on the cheek and left. And I think I fell a little bit in love with him that night. I think I did, although I didn't see him again till all this had happened with Art and I had left him and was going back to Waniwak to see my sister. And that was where I saw him again. And that was actually how that happened. But I never forgot that night that he was so kind to me when I told him things that I never told anybody. My sister didn't know. And I remember saying to my sister, I can't believe I told him that. I can't believe I told him all that. And, you know, and he never told us another soul. And I guess I knew that he wouldn't.
What was he like?
It's hard to explain. If you knew Waniwak, sometimes with people in Waniwak, all I've had to say is he's an Enos. And they say, oh, okay, I get it. But he was an alcoholic, and the agreement when we got married was that he was going to go into treatment and quit drinking, which he did 6 months after we got married. But I don't know how familiar you are with alcoholics, but they do go through a dry drunk phase. And so we spent a lot of years. I make it sound like it was so difficult, and loving him wasn't hard. And I'll tell you, because he got it. He got it. Art didn't have a clue. Ronnie had a clue. There are people who have a clue. They just have a clue. I don't think Andy has a clue. Truthfully, I don't. But I think John, his younger brother, does have a clue. I don't know that Mark has a clue, but I think Matt does. It's interesting. I guess it's in their makeup, and Andy went through. There's probably lots of traumatic experiences that I don't know about. I didn't know about him getting locked in the closet. And I think but Ronnie had a clue. So I could talk to him about Art, and he was never threatened by it, but he didn't ever tell me I was crazy. He would let me go through the feelings. He would let me deal with it. And he put his own children through rough times when they were young, because he was an alcoholic. And one time he was kind of minimizing it, which is what alcoholics do. They minimize it. And I said to him, his daughter was there, and I said, let me just interject here, Ronnie. Just let me interject here. I am the adult child of an alcoholic who has married two alcoholics. I said, you have no idea the scars that are left on children when they grow up like that. And even though you didn't physically hurt those kids, your alcoholism hurt them. It changed who they were. So don't think your daughters were not affected by your drinking, because they were. They were deeply affected by it. And he sat back, and he could see that he was thinking, and he looked at his daughter, and he said, I am so sorry that I put you through that. And so he got it. He eventually got it. He did have a clue, because he did get it, and he made his amends for it. Art never made his amends up until the day he died. He blamed everybody else. His kids owed him.
Do you know what Kathy's talking about when she says Ronnie had a clue? Some people have a clue, some don't.
I think it could be taken a few different ways. For me, I would take it as a self-reflection. They're able to look at themselves and evaluate and understand that their actions are having consequences to those around them. I guess it's also a difference, because you could take it a step further. Just because you can recognize that your actions are affecting those around you doesn't mean that you have enough self-reflection or motivation to change, to then stop what you're doing and improve the situation of those around you. For me, it could be another ways. At the baseline, I'm going to take it as the first one that he's able to self-reflect. She did mention that he went through episodes of sobriety. So again, he is making that change. And like with any addiction, it's something that's a lifelong battle, something that you have to always face. Him being in a bar, though, at the start, kind of during his sobriety, really putting yourself in the thick of it, I guess, you know, really testing your willpower.
Right.
But I think everyone can relate to that. Sometimes it's easier to open up to those who are third party or have no insight into your life. And Ronnie was probably in the right place at the right time for her and was that person. And I think that another thing that helped her is that because he's gone through it and he was displaying patterns that Art wasn't, again, having that clue kind of, I don't want to say the word liberated, but like made her feel a little bit more free to open up and knew that he understood what she was going through.
That's something that Kathy and I were actually talking about during this interview as well, is that it's often easier to open up to people that aren't active members of your life. Because a lot of the stuff she was telling me, she would often follow it up by saying, I've never been able to tell my kids this kind of stuff. And the reason she was able to open up to me is because I'm far from an active member of her life. I'm just someone who's there and willing to listen to her story.
And at the end of the day, I think we can all relate that sometimes we just want someone to just listen as we talk. They don't even have to say anything. They don't have to agree or comment, but just to have someone that they can to open up to.
So by this time, Kathy had removed herself from Art's life, but there was one point where she was forced back into it, not for Art or for herself, but more for her family and her sons.
The day of Art's funeral, the kids and all four of them rallied around Art in the last 3 weeks of his life. They did. They all of them put their lives on hold and took care of Art. And I remember saying to Art's sister the day of the funeral, I'm so glad that my boys had these last 3 weeks with their dad to reestablish a connection. And she said yes, and they owed him. And I didn't say anything, and she said, especially Mark. I walked out of there, out of that funeral dinner, and thought, because up to that point, I had been very, very sympathetic to the boys, very, very determined not to say anything bad about their dad. And I thought, what did you tell her? You potlucker, you never took responsibility for your actions when you were alive, and now you're not taking any responsibility when you're dead. She still thinks that it was me and the kids who abandoned you. It was not, and whatever these boys did or did not do. I know for a fact that every family gathering with all of them, they invited their dad, whether he chose to come or not. That was another story. That was another story. If they went golfing together, it was because Art wanted to go golfing. If they, and the kids weren't, not any of them, no, none of them were interested in hunting. So Art went hunting on his own, took trips out west, and went on fishing trips all over and all this, because it was what he wanted to do. I don't like to label anybody, but I would say he was probably a narcissist. About a week after he died, I wrote the kids this email. And I told them what Julianne had said, and I told them a little bit about the history. And I know one of the things that I said was that your dad left our marriage long before I did. And I don't remember everything. It's buried somewhere in the bowels of my emails. But what I did was, okay, there again. See, Andy and John Boy we called him. I haven't called him that for a long time. They saw more because Matt and Mark's reaction was they were really mad at me for what I said. I didn't chop their dad up in pieces, but I told him a few things that had gone on. And that he had left the marriage long before I did. And I told him what Julianne, Art's sister, had said and how and why it had such a reaction, why I reacted like I did.
So just to clarify, Kathy received a letter.
She wrote the email.
Oh.
So what she's saying there at the end is a couple of weeks after Art's death, after his funeral, she wrote an email trying to explain to her sons what she had gone through in that relationship. Kathy and I, throughout the interview, this theme of coming to terms with who your parents are kept popping up because throughout Kathy's life, she's had to reconcile herself with who her father really was and how her parents have impacted her own life and her own relationships. And now we kind of see the point where her sons are having to do the same. They have to realize and have to come to terms with who their father was, whether that's who he was to them or who he was to everyone else in his life as well.
It's a tough thing to do because you've grown up with this idea of who your parents are, who their father was, who their mother was. And it is often and unfortunate that when someone passes that, a lot of skeletons are kind of dragged out of the closet. And a lot of the issues, it takes courage and strength for you to explain everything that's happened to like let people understand. And I don't know if it's covered later on in the interview, but, you know, hopefully one day her kids will understand, you know, everything that's happened and why she felt the need to let them know.
Here we see this highly negative relationship in Kathy's life. We see the door closing on it for good. Unfortunately, it wouldn't be long before the door would also close on her second relationship with her second husband, Ronnie.
It's interesting. Because I loved this man enough to marry him and have four children and stay with him all those years. But when he died, I didn't have any grief. I had no grief. No grief whatsoever. I felt bad for my kids. And I felt bad for what might have been. If I grieved at all, I'd done my grieving before that. Did I feel that way when Ronnie died? No. I've really grieved. And you know, part of it, Troy, is that Ronnie loved me more than anybody's ever loved me other than my mother. And I knew that. And I sensed it. And not everybody gets that gift. Not everybody gets the gift of knowing that someone loves you that much. And I, the day he died, I said to him, and he was, you know, they say the hearing is the last thing to go, and I believe it. Because I said to him, he was unresponsive, but I said, you know, Ronnie, I said, I love two men in my life. I love two men. Art was one of them, and I had four sons with him. And then I met you, and I loved you. And I said, I've loved you totally differently than I loved Art, but I can tell you that I never loved Art like I do you. And that was the truth. That was the truth. What I felt for Ronnie was so totally different than what I felt for Art. But I also realized that Art never loved me like Ronnie did. And Ronnie understood me. He understood me when I'd go off on my rants and my tangents. And we'd fight. We'd argue. One time I grabbed the cap off his head and was whipping him across the head with his hat. That was before he got so sick. But somehow he ended up in the emergency room a few days later. And the nurse asked all these questions. And she said, Ron, do you feel safe in your own home? And he looked at me. He looked at me and I said, yes, he does. So that kind of sums it up. And I just knew that when he got sick that I didn't want to be anywhere else. That was where I wanted to be.
I like that she was able to find the part that she was missing in her relationship with Art that she found in Ronnie. Essentially that she had someone who loved her back as much as, you know, her own mother did. And she was able to kind of enjoy that time with them despite having ups and downs. Relationships have ups and downs. Friendships have ups and downs. And you can really feel like how much she cared because she said, you know, when he got sick, like that's all where she wanted to be. Like there was nowhere else.
It's always nice to hear that people who've had such large struggles in their life for so much of their life are given an opportunity to experience a positive relationship themselves. Kathy went from living through her childhood with her father to a rough marriage with art. And kind of like you were talking about, she finally got to enjoy years of her life with Ronnie. During our interview, Kathy also said that Ronnie was like a father to her sons. One of them, Andy, even admitted to Kathy at one point that Ronnie was more of a father to him than Art ever was. Most of this interview focused on the people in Kathy's life. But near the end, I asked Kathy, what about her?
What would you say is your biggest achievement?
I don't think I've reached it yet. I don't think I'm quite there. You know, my goal, you know what my goal is, Troy? My goal is that my kids, because there's way more to me than my kids think is there. And my goal is, and I don't know if I have to do it by starting to write just things down, because there's so much more to me than my kids know. They don't, and that I said to my friend Betty, I said, I want my kids to know who I am, because she knows who I am probably better than anyone. And I said, I want my kids to know that. And that's, so I don't think I've reached my full potential yet. There's the usual, the trite, you know, you try to be a good person and yada, yada, yada. And I probably, my biggest achievement is that people trust me. People trust me, and I have lots of people who care about me. And not everybody can say that. Not everybody can say that they have all these resources that they can pull in if they needed to. So that, if that's an achievement, that's probably my biggest achievement. And it's that I didn't grow up. My sister grew up kind of mean and ornery. And I'm glad, and I hope I didn't grow up mean and ornery. That's not to say I can't get ornery. But I think having love and respect of people is probably my biggest achievement. But I do want my kids to know who I am.
So far that we've heard in this interview is essentially she's been defined by her relationships, that what people have perceived of her, especially when she was married to Art, is everything in the newspaper. You know, she was the wife of Art Thompson. And she can recognize that essentially that is the case, that she has been defined by what other people believe or what other people perceive, and, you know, through her relationships. Hopefully she's able to find that voice, find that outlet to finally let people know, like, who she is and get that chance.
This is another example of Kathy's sons having to come to terms with who their parents really were. Not only do they have to come to some kind of realization of who their father was, but now Kathy is hoping to show her sons who she really is as well.
And defining yourself is hard. You know, like if I was to ask you, or if you were to ask me, you know, like, who is Troy, who is Keegan, can you define that? I mean, some people definitely can. You know, that's great. I don't know if I could. And I think a lot of people search for that. You know, people find it in, you know, other outlets by the clothes that they wear, the things that they do, what they post on social media. But like, it comes on, like, who are you? What do you want the world to know about you?
In our next episode of Tales Through Time, we will be going back to the story that helped kick off this entire podcast, the history and the lifelong relationship between Daryl and Vicky Newman.
You can keep up to date with Tales Through Time on Facebook, Patreon, and Twitter. That's TalesThruTime. One thing you can do that would be incredibly helpful to our podcast is to follow or subscribe on whichever streaming service you are using to listen to us. Any ratings and reviews are always appreciated.
Please reach out to us if you have story ideas of your own as well. Recording in Minneapolis
and Fort Worth,
I'm Troy Newman.
And I'm Keegan Redwick. Thank you for joining us.